Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
So can y'all tell me a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do on the internet, what you think you're doing over there on your fancy website?
Fancy website. I mean, it looks very fancy, yeah, but making not as much money as I think people would expect. But yeah, you know, I'm Joseph Cox, one of the co-founders of 404 Media, and we wake up and we find crazy articles or investigations to produce. What about you, Emmanuel?
I'm Emmanuel Myberg. I am a co-founder of 404 Media, previously the executive editor at Motherboard and Matthew's boss, now his humble servant. Very happy to be here. A big fan of Matthew's work.
Thank you so much. So y'all are here because you've published some things recently that made me absolutely furious when I saw them. The way only a jealous blogger can feel.
It's real. That's the real form of jealousy. Yeah.
I was so mad. I was so mad when I saw the OSINT one specifically, because I saw it and I was like, I should have fucking done that. I'm so mad.
Well, we'll get into it, but this was Emmanuel's idea. Like, we get in a meeting, like we sometimes do, and Emmanuel's like, here's one idea. And I said, that's a good one. And then I pinged some sources, and then we got it up, like, immediately, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's very pertinent now, especially in the context of, like, what we've been doing on Angry Planet lately, because it's become very hard, when talking about the Israel-Hamas war, to find like credible information. And listeners, thank you, some of you who reached out. Everyone was very polite, actually, about a recent episode that we had. There were a couple of things in there that were not exactly true. I think there was some heated discussion, some people saying some things that I think they meant, but were... They were taking some of what governments are saying at first blush, and not doing the follow up. So I'm going to address some of that a little bit later, listeners. But thinking about that, I was thinking about like how hard it has become with this war specifically just to figure out what the fuck is going on. So we used to have an information space that wasn't great. On social media, on Twitter specifically, where you had a community of people that used open source intelligence to navigate the front lines of these conflicts and report what was going on in places like Bellingcat and other specific individuals like Caliber Obscura, who you talk with in one of your pieces on 404, did a really good job of kind of parsing through everything that was going on and giving people the truth of the situation as they saw it. Now, though, on Twitter, it is a sea of high follower count blue check marks with the words OSINT somewhere in their title. They are rushing to get information out. Sometimes they're posting footage from Arma 3, which is like, you know... An old trick. It's a trick as old as the internet at this point, basically. Like every major conflict, Arma 3 footage circulates. But the problem is, though, the way the website works now, the algorithm promotes this stuff. And the next 20 replies, instead of being something kind of debunking it or making a different claim, it's a bunch of other blue check marks kind of piling on or making memes and jokes. And that's kind of the signaled noise ratio is out of whack. All that to say, y'all wrote a great blog, the two of you, at 404 about this. Can you tell me about it?
Emmanuel, why don't you go ahead? I mean, it was your original very smart idea, and I can jump in after you, maybe.
So, we, I think, to be frank, were caught a little off guard as a new media organization about how to cover it. I think, you know, we've only been up since August, late August, and until now, we've been able to pursue whatever stories we thought were most interesting and worth pursuing. And that really worked well, and our audience really enjoyed it, and we really enjoyed it. And I think, you know, towards the middle of this week, I had done a story about the war, and then I went back to kind of my regular beat reporting, as did everyone else. But we realized that we had to engage with it for practical reasons, for business reasons, and then also for public interest reasons. It's just the only thing that is occupying people's minds right now for good reason.
Yeah.
And we wanted to get into it. And I think being only four reporters and not being on the ground and not being there, and not speaking the languages. I speak Hebrew, but I don't speak Arabic. It's very hard to report on a conflict like this in a way that is responsible. But what we can do is talk about the place we are embedded in and are very familiar with, which is the internet, and which is Twitter specifically and other social media platforms. And it gave us an opportunity to talk about something that has been, I think, rising in the last year. Matthew, you're very familiar with it. I think that this is something that has been kind of boiling since the full-on invasion of Russia into Ukraine, and the rise of open source intelligence, not just as a thing for nerdy journalists and people who are like conflict analysts and think tanks, and it just sort of like a thing that more people are familiar with, everyone on the internet is familiar with, and more people are participating in. And I have been doing it for a long time. It's a very useful tool, or it's a very useful method for reporting and verifying world events. And I just noticed that kind of some of the veteran open source intelligence people were getting pretty mad about some of the other viral open source intelligence accounts, and not being, I think, as blunt as we were in our story, but kind of like hinting like, hey, I don't know about this. You know what I mean? It's just like, open source intelligence is great and it's important, but there's a lot of stuff out there that doesn't seem like good information for people to retweet. And that was kind of the idea of the story, and relating that issue specifically to this war. And I think, I mean, and I think we'll get into why it's such an acute problem in this specific conflict, but it kind of took some of the problems we've seen in the war in Ukraine and made them so much more obvious, that we kind of just had to address the problem, which is, It's a very popular genre of post, and people are engaging with it, and people are creating this type of content, it seems, first and foremost for engagement and not for verifying news or claims by various governments. It's just a game. It kind of turned into a game.
Can we talk about what has happened? I mean, obviously, one of the main reasons that this is happening is that Twitter has changed in the past year since Musk took over. So the incentives of the website themselves, which were already not great, have kind of been heightened or accelerated in a way that makes it harder, I think, to get to the truth. Can you tell me, like, what specifically has changed on the website that has made this kind of engagement so frenzied and popular?
Look, there's always been misinformation on Twitter. It sort of ebbs and flows depending on conflict that's at the center of it, or, as you say, certain product changes. You know, there was misinfo when Russia invaded Ukraine, what, in February 2022, right? But what has happened now, I think in June, was that Musk made certain changes to profit, monetization, and engagement on Twitter that at the time kind of seemed like just stupid little decisions. And now we're seeing like the really serious consequences of them. And specifically, I'm talking about that if you pay to be verified on Twitter, you know, the $8 a month or whatever, and you get your blue tick, you can actually get paid out by Twitter for the amount of engagement you get from other verified users. So you'll see people do viral tweets, sometimes in the style of like a cringe, like LinkedIn post, something like that, like a thinkfluencer or whatever they call themselves. And then all the replies will be from verified people, and their replies will be at the top because that's another benefit of being verified. These people get catapulted to the top of the replies. Now, you can already see, well, that's going to encourage people to post content that puts engagement basically above anything else, because that is how they can potentially get money. And we don't know all the ins and outs of how much exactly people are getting paid, but you know, there were people like Tim Pool, right, who tweeted, I think, screenshots showing that he was making thousands of dollars off it or something. I haven't checked in on that sort of ecosystem in a little while, but people are making apparently some money from this. Now, take that engagement and profit driven set of motivations and dump it into the Israel-Palestine conflict, and it's an absolute mess. You have these people who, as far as I know, are not experts. They're certainly not the trusted series of OSINT specialists that I followed for years and years and years. They've come out of nowhere. They just have a suit and a blue tick, and they're doing these really long tweets where it's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not reading all of that. But they... look, I can't be in their head, and it would be unfair to say why exactly what they're doing is. I can't say they're just making it up, but I can say that their information is wrong, and it is being, in some cases, is wrong, and it's being presented as OSINT. And that change to you could potentially get paid out on Twitter, I think, is really what makes this wave of misinfo different to what we've had before.
Yeah, whenever you add a financial incentive to something, people are going to do it. They're going to push the button, just full stop, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you could even trace it back to the sort of clickbait era of journalism. You know, like, that's kind of past us now. Like, I don't think it's effective. People don't really do it as much. But it's that sort of thing, just being applied here to a new platform and all, kind of a new medium, I guess.
So I really saw this in the wake of the bombing of the hospital. I think it was particularly bad. And it seemed to me that we've got this place now on Twitter specifically where people have made a decision about what happened there. And then they can find the OSINT account that reflects their belief, and it will have a picture with graphs. You'll get to see a guy say, well, you know, I have heard what a JDAM sounds like when it's exploding. So obviously that's what happened here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And Emmanuel, you'd said something earlier I wanted to circle back to, that there's something about this conflict specifically that has hypercharged all of this. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that everything we just said is true. But the Israel-Palestine conflict has been going on for, I mean, depending on when you want to count, like 70 years, 100 years. And it has always been true before the internet, before open source intelligence, before AI, before all of this stuff. People involved in the conflict directly and people commenting on the conflict cannot agree on basic facts. Like, people cannot agree on a basic timeline, on what specific people did, on the specifics of agreements and who agreed to them or disagreed to them. There is, I will speak only for, like, the Israeli side, because it's the side that I am more familiar with, having grown up there. But it's like there's a very intense, very effective mythology building apparatus, and you can see that play out, you know, via the official government Twitter accounts and Instagram accounts. So I mean, that's basically it. And what happens now that open source intelligence is a thing that many people are familiar with is just an extension of that. It's exactly what you said, where people have their narrative, people have their ideas about what is happening and why, and you can just go to the internet and pull whatever quote-unquote evidence fits your version of events. But you don't need the internet for that, and you don't need Twitter for that, and you don't need open source intelligence for that. Before all of that, people would just reference different books and different historians and different commentators and different government statements. So we're just seeing more of it faster. And I would say one thing that is new here is that, like, there's like two new tools here at play. One is open source intelligence, which, and they both do the same thing, which is give the claims an aura of credibility and an aura of, like, a scientific method. Like, when you take an image and you mark it up with lines and you reference, like, specific munitions, it kind of makes it sound like you're doing actual research and you're presenting legitimate evidence. And similarly, when you take a photograph and you enter it into an AI image detecting tool and it spits out a result, it makes it seem like a more credible claim because you have used a tool that is doing computer science behind the scenes and it's spitting out a result. And then you can be like, look, the tool said that I am correct.
Look at that segue. You've been podcasting.
Hell yeah.
Look at that. All right. So the other, another story y'all wrote that I wanted to talk about is this AI detection tool. It's called AI or Not. It's from a company called Optic. It predates the war, obviously. What is the purpose of it, and how has it been, I don't know if weaponized is the right word, but how's it being used now?
Yeah, it's not weaponized, it's not far off. It's definitely deployed to people's, you know, specific ends. So yeah, I think we're kind of a couple of years into text-to-image AI tools becoming very popular and accessible. Anyone can find some sort of tool on the internet where can they type a prompt and an AI uses that prompt to create an image. And for many, I think, good reasons, people have responded to the proliferation of AI images by creating AI image detecting tools, which also in an automated fashion, you put an image into the tool and it will tell you whether it is generated by AI or a human, or what it thinks the likely, whether it's likely to be human or likely to be AI. A good reason for this to exist, for example, like one of the creators of these tools that I talked to said that the purpose of it originally was to help Reddit moderators detect AI art. So it's like there's all these art subreddits and they were created for humans by humans. And people have started creating AI images and putting them into those subreddits. Matthew, I think you wrote a story about like this AI image that won an art fair, right? And nobody knew that it was AI generated. So somebody made a tool where you can like initially like sort through images and be like, is this likely AI or likely human? And then another good reason in theory is, you know, we're talking about this messy information ecosystem. So it in theory, it would be useful if you had a tool where you can just like give an image to a computer and the computer says whether it's real or not. In reality, however, the way these tools work is very similar to the way that the AI image generating tools work. You take a bunch of real images and you take a bunch of AI image, like AI generated images, and you train an AI on both, and it kind of just like, and then you give it a new image and it says like, oh, this looks more like the AI images I've been trained on, or this looks more like the real images that I've been trained on. And, you know, on the high end, like the professional, like the very good detectors that are licensed to corporations and governments and cost thousands of dollars to access, it's not a thing you could just like look up on the internet. They have, you know, like 90%, 95% accuracy, according to the people who make them, which is, you know, 90 to 95 sounds good, but that's also plenty of errors. And it also is still automated, right? Like it's just comparing one set of images to another, and it's not a perfect method.
Right. And sometimes the stakes can be a little high on that 10% that it fails on, right? Which is a bit what we've seen in this war. And it seems like both the one of the things that I think is driving both the OSINT problem and this AI image detection problem, and we'll get into a little bit more the specifics of the AI detection here in a second, is this human need for certainty and discomfort with ambiguity or the unknown. We live in this world where we think we can get the facts immediately, and the truth about a war zone and a conflict is that there is a fog of war. It is incredibly hard to know exactly what is going on at any given moment, even if you're on the ground, especially if you're on the ground, right? And so you may not find out what happened somewhere for weeks, months, years, until lots of eyes are on it. The evidence has been poured over and gone through by like a series of trained investigators. But the way that the internet works, we want to know exactly what happened immediately, so we can render our judgment calls or whatever we need to do for ourselves. And that is just simply not the way that the world works, as much as we would like to trick ourselves into thinking it is.
I guess there's a tension there in that, you know, we are so used to immediate information and the benefits that can provide of sharing information. You know, even going back to the Arab Spring, that people constantly point to as, you know, this is the moment that social media showed it can really do something positive. And yeah, I think you're, you know, bringing up the realities around war is a very, very good one. There was already a fog of war. There's always going to be a fog of war because we're talking about bullets and bombs and kinetic events. You know, you can't like scale up the information side of that just as much as everybody would love to. You know, just sit down and wait and be comfortable with the fact that you don't know, but people of course, as you say, don't want to do that.
And you have both sides now generating images to generating images, audio, video to feed into these systems, right, to kind of propel their own narrative forward. Like Ukraine, I think, has been very successful at that since Russia invaded. Like I see a lot of FPV video of drones dropping, like killing Russian soldiers with the Benny Hill theme song over it, right? And people with cartoon Shiba Inu dog avatars on Twitter share that shit everywhere. And it becomes very popular and kind of gets worked into the narrative. Right. So I think we also have to be really careful about sharing and believing information when we want to believe it, especially about a war. because it may not always reflect the grim reality of what's actually happening. And with that in mind, can we talk about the specific images that kind of went around and were debunked, not debunked by this AI image detector? Like, why did this become a big deal these past few weeks?
So how it becomes a big deal, I think, begins before the image even appeared. And that begins with the claim from Benjamin Netanyahu, who, and from here on out, I reserve the right to call him BB because he was my prime minister for 20 years or so. He talked to Joe Biden and he said that Hamas had decapitated 40 babies, which was a statement that Joe Biden repeated and the entire world heard and some media outlets repeated. And then understandably, people wanted to verify that claim and they could not. And Israel did not provide any evidence that this has happened. And since then, Joe Biden had, like, he walked back the statement and Israel did as well, though not as much.
When you say not as much, like, what was their...
I think they, so the IDF, I think, said that they don't have evidence of this happening. We're getting into the minutia here, because I've been following this very closely, but it's like, IDF said, like, actually, there's no evidence of this. We don't have any, like, evidence to support this claim. But then, I think it was the official Israel Twitter account that retweeted a Jerusalem Post news story that said that they had verified it, but the Jerusalem Post, as far as I have seen so far, has also not produced evidence, right? So it's like, on the one hand, you have IDF saying that it's like, we don't have any evidence of this, but the official Israeli government account is retweeting accounts that are saying that it happened. That's kind of why I'm saying they're waffling. So, like, this is the environment that we were in, right? And it's like you have this horrendous claim and then no evidence and people are doubting that the, you know, Israel government is telling the truth. And as a response to that, they tweet out these horrific images of what they say are, like, there's two images of a burnt corpse of a baby and then one image of, like, the bloody corpse of a baby. And at Israel tweeted it, and then the prime minister's account tweeted it as well. And as a result of that, Ben Shapiro, who is a conservative Jewish commentator, tweeted it also with the same sentiment, which is like, oh, you doubt us, you doubt that there were war crimes, like, look at this image. And in response to him, people replied to his tweet with screenshots of this tool that you mentioned, AI or not, which shows that they fed the tool the image, and then the tool says this image is likely to have been produced by AI to kind of debunk those images as well.
And then it ends up as a community note underneath Ben Shapiro's tweet, right?
I know that people said that, and I've seen screenshots of that. I wasn't able to verify that independently, but it definitely seems that way. Yeah.
But we... don't, but the image is, how shall I phrase this? It is not AI generated, as best as we can tell.
I think the thing that you are being careful there about, which I will be as well, is that it is a photograph. I am very confident that it is a photograph. As to when the photograph was taken and what is it of, that I do not know.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back, Angry Planet listeners. We're back on with the 404 Media Boys. Can I step back here and ask kind of a meta question that's been running through my head as we have, maybe not a meta question, but it's been running through my head as we have these discussions. We have all these conversations about, like, were babies beheaded? Were they killed? How much does, I mean, we know kids were killed, right? Like, as best we can tell, Hamas did kill children in that initial attack. Right? Does it matter if they were beheaded or not? Does it matter if we have photographic evidence or not when we have, like, eyewitness testimony from people? Like, does that question make sense? Like, are we equivocating?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very difficult question, and I will try to engage with it. It does matter, right? It's like facts matter. I wrote this in my story. It's just like, our lives are facts, right? It's like, this is what I get paid to do, to verify facts. That's a big part of my job. So it definitely matters. And, you know, eventually, like, the fog of war will dissipate, and we will want an account of what happened exactly, like every detail of what happened, right? It's like, and this is true about everything. It's like 9/11 happens. It's a crazy event. People die. You have to... So many things are happening, but it's like years later, it's like you want to read a 2,000-page report about what happened and why, because we need to understand and we need to learn what has happened if we want to prevent it from happening again, or I don't know. We just, history is important, and the facts of history are important. I think it is important. Does it help anyone big picture to resolve this conflict or reach a ceasefire or stop the killing or get closer to a peace deal if the babies were beheaded or burned alive, or if 3,000 people died, or if 2,000 people died, or 1,000 people? I'm not so sure of that. It's like, people have the right to know, and it's totally fine to demand to know, and it's totally fine to be outraged when you are lied to or when you think you are being lied to. Like, all of that is very fair. That being said, I personally, like, this is my opinion. I think that at the moment, there is probably a better way to prioritize what kind of discussions we want to have in order to get to better outcomes. And I don't think that is one of those discussions, right? It's like, the discussions that need to happen, that are happening, right? They're happening behind closed doors, but it's like, how do we get aid into Gaza, right? How do we stop the bombing of Gaza? How do we reach some sort of agreement between these two factions so the violence stops and we can, like, halt the killing and start the rebuilding? And you know what I mean? It's just like, those are the kind of discussions that we need to have. And then eventually we need to have this other discussion as well, as part of, like, you know, in South Africa, they called it, like, truth and reconciliation. It's like, it is actually very important for people to know what happened, because if we don't acknowledge what has happened, we can't, like, heal and move on from the trauma of it and have people feel like they were heard and their experiences are valid and so on and so on. Yeah. Does that answer your question at all?
No, it does. I really want to, I'm glad you got into this with me, because we had like a former IDF guy on the last episode who repeated the beheaded babies thing. And it was pretty early in the conversation around it. And some audience members got mad, understandably, I think. So thank you for kind of walking me through this from that perspective. I think that's
my perspective. I'm not speaking for anyone else.
So, your personal perspective, which I do think is, you know, informed and important on this specific issue, right? You said you'd been following it closely. So I really appreciate you kind of trying to suss this out with me. So I do think it's important. And I don't know. I just like, it's so weird right now. Maybe it was just because I wasn't like, it feels like social media was not as active the last time there was a huge conflict between Israel and Palestine. And I'm sure you've got a completely different view. It feels extremely heated right now. Tensions are running high. Everyone's emotions are running high, especially the emotions and tensions of people who are not there. And that's a lot of what I see, unfortunately. And I think that that also doesn't help with the fog of war and with trying to suss out like what's real and what's fake. Everyone would rather just go on Twitter and find the OSINT image that reflects what they believe. So at least there's Telegram.
The harbinger of truth, Telegram. The one true tome of knowledge is a group of Telegram group chats now.
Can you, are you both on Telegram?
Yeah. But it,
Joe more than me. Joe more than
yeah,
me.
But yeah, but in a much more, that's where cyber criminals hang out. And I deliberately have not joined the Israel-Palestine conflict Telegram groups because it's where exceptionally graphic material is being shared. And, you know, I'm very appreciative of the people, first of all, who are uploading it if they're trying to document the process. And, of course, the OSINT, the legitimate OSINT researchers who do use that. But, yeah, it's a bottleneck and a funnel, but I'm not dipping into that yet, you know, because I don't need to see some of this horrible, horrible stuff after covering ISIS on Telegram for years. I think I've seen enough brutality for a little bit, you know.
I didn't know you covered Islamic State on Telegram. I don't think
I did a series of stories about ISIS propaganda, and especially on like how it was getting on YouTube and that sort of thing. This was back when, you know, social media platforms still had a massive problem with ISIS propaganda. And a lot of that did involve going into Telegram and seeing the source and, you know, some very horrible stuff in there, which I'm sure there's lots of horrible stuff on Telegram right now as well.
There is. Yeah, no, it's, you can get a much more raw version of events that are happening on the ground on Telegram, which I think is one of the reasons it has become kind of like a first order place for a lot of people. A lot of people who do what we do, a lot of people are just reposting things they've seen on Telegram on Twitter, right?
I forget who said it. I don't know if I really, maybe you should look it up, but somebody said it very well. He said, all war footage is downstream from Telegram. I think it was one of the Bellingcat people, but
Higgins or maybe Eric, who's now at New York Times. But yeah. I think they've both kind of ranted recently about how they've seen a lot of war footage that they first see on Telegram. And then like a day or two later ends up on Twitter, with either a watermark added or removed. And then they don't share the source of like which Telegram channel they got it from. Right.
Well, that's also definitely the case in just the piece we were talking about earlier about OSINT and Israel-Palestine, was because Caliber Obscura said that as well. The weapons specialist, who's also a long-running OSINT expert, they pointed specifically to how a lot of the stuff on Twitter is material just taken from Telegram, as you say. But he added that this is a quote, usually without context and usually with their own bias inserted. End quote. Which, yeah, that's what we're seeing on Twitter. Like, people, at least, you know, the blue ticks or whatever, the verified users, a lot of them will say, you know, this is, you know, the platform of free speech and all that. And it's like, no, everything's being put through some sort of like frame here, you know, worse than a lot of places. I'm not encouraging people go watch raw war footage on Telegram. I don't think ordinary people necessarily want to do that. But yes, that is where the footage is coming from, especially in this conflict.
And it's also important to remember that a lot of Telegram channels, a lot of the big Telegram channels that are sharing information are run by local governments, local organizations. It is not as if there is... I mean, there are journalists on the ground that are using Telegram, but a lot of the information streams are coming from state sources, you know, on both sides of the conflict that are generating this stuff, right? So I think that that's like an important caveat too. I think my favorite Caliber Obscura thing I saw in the last couple day, last week or two was there was a picture of ostensibly like Hamas soldiers with assault rifles that went around, and people were retweeting it, saying like, "Where did they get these M4s from? You know, those are American guns." And he was like, "Those are not. You guys have no idea what guns those are. Shut the fuck up." Idiots. So yeah, Caliber Obscura is a really great, still a good Twitter account that is worth following. Learn lots about arms and armaments from them.
The one thing I'll just say on that, and this didn't really come into the piece because this is more just my personal observation, but I used to get a ton of information from all of these OSINT accounts that are mentioned in the piece, you know, and including Ballincat and all that, and it's kind of hard to put my finger on because you can't necessarily point to a specific change beyond the fact that, you know, Musk has now split Twitter into a For You stream and the following stream. Mm-hmm. You click between them, whatever, it depends what you're trying to do. But I think we probably all agree with this, at least anecdotally. It's just harder to see the stuff you actually are interested in and want to see. And I swear I just don't see the good OSINT stuff anymore. I'm following them. I'm sometimes engaging with their posts. It doesn't mean I see their actual information. So hard to put my finger on, but there's like a more subtle change there as well.
I think that, I think that that is absolutely true. I've noticed that the amount of like weird algorithmically served like meme channels and like shitpost channels and just kind of garbage engagement farming content that I am served on Twitter is grown exponentially. Like that is definitely what the website wants to show me. It does not want me seeing like what the people I'm following are tweeting about at all, especially if they're not paying for the website. So let me ask you this last question. First of all, where can people go to find more of your work? And second, how do we navigate these spaces now? Like what is the best practice for being online and trying to figure out what the hell's going on?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, if you've enjoyed listening to what me and Emmanuel have spoken about, you can certainly go to 404media.co. which is the website where we publish our articles. But I would especially encourage you to actually check out our podcast, the very imaginatively named 404 Media Podcast. Search that wherever you get podcasts. And, you know, every week we talk for about 30 to 45 minutes about the stories we've published. And that includes a lot of stuff about AI, conflict, crime for me. It really depends what happens that week. But we actually talk about these specific stories as well. So if you want even more specifics, go check out that episode. As for like, how do we navigate this ecosystem? I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think we all have at 404 Media, because it's part of the reason why we actually quit Vice and made our own media company, right? Very small, very, very tiny, but our own media company. And the way I would characterize it is that we have all of these fragmented platforms now. Twitter is going down the drain for all the reasons we just explained. Not everybody is on Mastodon. Blue Sky doesn't seem to have enough of the hard-hitting stuff at the moment. Even LinkedIn, like I'm using more, which I didn't think I would ever do. And maybe not the solution, but one way we're mitigating it, at least for our readers, is that you come to our website, you give us your email address, and then you know, we will email you when we get a big scoop or when we a newsletter roundup, which sounds really stupid, almost like me saying it out loud. Like, that's not a new idea. Yes, but like the importance of direct to reader information now has only increased as all these platforms have either gone down in quality or sort of crumbled and everybody's spread out. So I would encourage everybody, you know, find some platforms or rather some outlets or some experts who you trust, and maybe just like sign up to them directly. You know, I know some of these OSINT experts are like on Substack and stuff, and you know, that platform has its own issues, right? All of these platforms suck in some way or another, and we're all just trying to navigate the best and the worst of it. But I mean, look, for me personally, it's going back to email where I don't have to like climb through the mud to like find something that's actually useful.
Manuel Myberg, Joseph Cox, thank you so much for coming on to Angry Planet and walking us through this. That's all for this week, Angry Planet listeners. As always, Angry Planet is me, Matthew Galt, Jason Fields, and Kevin O'Dell. It's created by myself and Jason Fields. If you like us, if you really like us, please go to angryplanet.substack.com, kick us $9 a month, get commercial-free versions of the mainline episodes, and you get them early. We do have a bonus that's about to come out. That'll be nice. It's all edited. I just need to get it out. A lot of people have sent really nice messages and really sent very lovely things telling us they appreciate what we do. And it's been a pretty wild month or so, I think, to say the least. Had some really difficult conversations. And I just really appreciate everyone that's reached out and everyone that's said some pleasant things. Really does help in these dark times. We will be back next week with another conversation about conflict on an angry planet. Stay safe until then.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.